This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. Today, Jonathan Bennett joins me as we talk about the California Consumer Privacy Act. That's up next. Floss Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes security simple for your remote workforce. Check out lastpass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 583, recorded Wednesday, June 17th, 2020. California Consumer Privacy Act Tools. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including solutions from key partners like VMware. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. And by LastPass, prepare for the unexpected in your business with LastPass, trusted by over 17 million users and 61,000 businesses worldwide. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. Hey, everybody. I'm Doc Searles. This is Floss Weekly. My co-host this week is Jonathan Bennett. Hey there, Jonathan.
Hey, Doc.
There he
is. How are you
there
today?
His face is here, then we know her. I have been better, but I'm up for the show, and the show must go on. So,
yes,
it's better to look good than to feel good, as Billy Crystal said. So, I'm looking good enough. So, and you're in Oklahoma somewhere.
I am. I'm here in I jokingly call it the flyover state, because most everybody that lives out in California and the East Coast, they just wave as they fly over. Here in the southwest corner of the state, in corporate headquarters, which is also my home office.
Yeah, and I've flown over it many times and photographed it many times. One of my favorite flyover states. I'm in Santa Barbara right now, and another 2 weeks I'll be back in New York. So that and waving to Oklahoma on the way. So thanks so much for being with us in LastPass Studios. And we'll pay for this first by getting going with an ad for our sponsor, which is Worldwide Technology. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. WWT began building their Advanced Technology Center, their ATC, it's called, 10 years ago, and it has grown exponentially. There's no other testing and research lab like it. It has more than $500 million in equipment, with hundreds of OEMs and key partners, ranging from high-tech heavyweights like VMware, Dell EMC, and Microsoft, and emerging disruptors like Equinix. WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade, because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right. The ATC is an incubator for IT innovation and offers on-demand and searchable labs like VMware Cloud on AWS, along with hundreds of other labs representing the newest advances in network visualization, software-defined data center, security, digital workspace, multi-cloud architecture, automation, and more. You can learn about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proofs of concept and pilots using the sandbox, so customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks and increases speed to market. They also offer lab as a service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here, customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem that WWT has already built. And it's virtual, so you can take full advantage of ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world, 24/7. WWT engineers work in these labs every day beta testing solutions based on the latest and greatest VMware technologies, and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster and with much less investment. WWT has launched their digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. This ecosystem creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world for their customers. Get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more about WWT and become a member of their growing community, go to wwt.com/twit to create an account and gain access to their on-demand labs today. WWT simplifies the complex. That's wwt.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. So welcome to Floss Weekly. And Jonathan and I are going to be joined today by Don Marty. Don Marty is an old friend and the former editor-in-chief of Linux Journal. He preceded me there and was by far the best editor we ever had. He was also a strategist for Mozilla. He's written for Linux Weekly News. He's been a speaker on user data targeting, signaling. My book, The Intention Economy, had two whole chapters on advertising that would not have been there or as good did I not have the help of Don, who has gone far beyond anything I ever wrote in that book in understanding how advertising and the entire ad-based ecosystem, if we can call it that, online works. And his expertise right now and most recently is on the CCPA, the California Consumer Privacy Act, which he studied incredibly closely. So welcome aboard, Don. Really great to have you here.
And there hi, Doc. He is. Great to be on the show. And hi, Jonathan.
Hey, how are you doing?
I found out before the show started that that we're dealing. You can't really tell when you're on these things. Here, those of you who are listening or watching, can't tell how tall somebody is. I just found a Jonathan 6'5". And what are you, Don? You're like 6'3" or 4", something like that.
6'2".
I look up to both these guys, even though we're looking across them now. So Don, I assume a lot of our listeners are in fact in California, but tell us about what the CCPA is, how it works, and how we as Floss people can screw with it and have fun with it, because you're always thinking like 3 or 4 chess moves ahead. And so I'd like to hear more about that.
Yeah. Well, the talk I did at Southern California Linux Expo was called Hacking the CCPA for Fun and Profit, which is kind of a well-used well-used talk title format. But really, the CCPA is a law that gives you a couple of basic legal tools that don't seem very useful by themselves, but if you put them together with the right technical tools, then you can really start to transform the market for user data and for content. And from the point of view of an individual, of course, a lot of people are going to be highly sensitive about how their personal data is used. But for most people, you look at your personal data and you say, well, what does it matter if I get an ad that's targeted to me based on the fact that I live in California or not? And the simple answer to that is that the money that's spent on advertising to reach you can go to one of three different kinds of places. It can go to sponsor content that you want to read or listen to. It can go to provide services that you want to use, like search, or it can be used in tracking and targeting you, which is the one piece of the action in the marketing budget that you don't see a benefit from. And you may actually see see harms from it as some of that data leaks out and is used for identity theft or fraud or that kind of stuff. So in the long run, everybody's got an interest in moving the market for your data away from the negative sum stuff and toward the positive sum stuff. So what are the tools that CCPA gives you? CCPA gives you the ability to send three different kinds of requests to a company. You can say, do not sell my personal information. You can say, I request to know all the information you have about me. And then you can say, I request that you delete my personal information. And all three of these have different definitions and exceptions to them. The CCPA definition of sell includes a lot of data transfers that most people wouldn't think of as a sale. But it's really those three tools plus a little extra stuff that gives you something you can build on.
If one opts out of selling, having your data sold, does it cover the others? Does it cover other uses? Is the safest thing to do? Is that the idea?
Well, if you send a do not sell, then whoever's got your information still has it. So if, for example, you get internet service from a local ISP and you send them a do not sell, well, they've still got your info. They can still deal with your customer service requests. You're still going to get email from them trying to upsell you to a better plan. None of your relationship with that company is going to change. So do not sell is the kind of request that you want to make of a company that you're actively doing business with or are considering doing business with in the future or both.
Hey, Don, I want to jump in and ask, I'm curious about this law when it only exists in California. What's the scope of that for people and businesses that are outside of the state of California? And it's something interesting we see here in the United States. Like, for example, you will see on a lot of furniture, they'll have this little tag that says something like, this piece of furniture contains chemicals known to cause cancer in the state of California. And for the rest of the country, there's this kind of this joke that we always say that goes, well, I never want to move to California if all these things cause cancer if you live there. So I'm just curious, what's the teeth on this law look like for someone that's not in California?
That depends on which companies you're doing business with. When CCPA first went into effect at the beginning of this year, people tried sending CCPA requests to companies from both inside and outside California. Now, some companies like AT&T fired back and said, you're not Californian. You don't get those CCPA rights. Go read the B-list privacy policy that we have for the other 49 states. Other companies like Microsoft announced that they would be doing CCPA rights for all their U.S. customers. And so I think part of it depends on how big the company is and how far they've thought out the edge cases of whether they'll choose to honor CCPA requests from outside California.
And then what about the other side of that coin? I kind of think about this as a small business owner. Is there some set of circumstances where I would suddenly have to care as a business owner about CCPA? And I guess I'm thinking about that, the additional burden of essentially having to figure out, all right, what are all of my if that does apply to me, what are all of the additional restrictions and regulations and all those things that I suddenly have to care about?
Yeah, the answer to that question is it depends on how many growth hacking videos your marketing department watched. If a small business has used a bunch of third-party services and taken their customer list and transferred it to a bunch of different places, then a CCPA request is kind of like, oh, now we have to go figure out what marketing's been doing for the past year or so. If the company has a less growth hackery mindset on what you do with the customer list, then complying with CCPA is a lot smaller of a request.
But what happens when you have a business that is in, say, well, Delaware, because a lot of them get incorporated in Delaware. You have a business that's incorporated in Delaware and they don't have anything brick and mortar in the state of California. If somebody sends a CCPA request, are they under any obligation to actually answer?
If they do business in the state of California, then they are obligated to comply with the law. So you don't get out of complying with CCPA just by not having a physical presence in the state.
That's interesting. I don't know how much we want to dive into the legal and the political ramifications of that. You get sort of the same thing with the GDPR and how, you know, Europe has written these regulations. In some ways, I think they're similar, and we'll probably ask you about that in a minute. But, you know, to a lot of us, it seems to be fundamentally a mistake to say that we're going to allow, you know, another country to write laws that then everyone globally has to fall under just because they're connected to the internet. But where do you fall on that? What do you think?
Well, the problem with the approach that marketing has been taking to marketing as a community of practice has been taking to privacy laws is it's sort of a two-phase approach, which is, well, let's try to resist every possible privacy law. And then when it does come along, let's comply with one privacy law at a time. And so this creates a tremendous amount of extra work for yourself, because the GDPR comes along and they try to capture kind of the ideal privacy policy for what they believe is the right thing to do according to the privacy norms of their people. And so GDPR comes out and marketers try to comply with it, change some systems here, add some dialogue boxes there, try to comply with the law as it's issued. Meanwhile, California is going through the same process. They're thinking about, oh, well, what are the privacy norms of the citizens of California? How do we best capture those in a law? And then they take that and they put it up as the CCPA. And so now you've got two privacy laws, both of which are sort of aiming at the same target. They're both trying to get at how do we implement the privacy norms of our citizens, but the actual text ends up being different. So the place where marketers are seeing the opportunity to get more done with less stress is, well, what if we look upstream of the privacy laws? Instead of saying, here's the text of the law, here's how we comply with it, what if we say, what are the user norms that the law is trying to capture? How do we build our systems for handling user data to reflect those norms? And then the details of complying with each individual law become a lot more manageable of a problem.
So let me look at this from a slightly different angle, which is from the individual angle. But start with, if you search for GDPR compliance, or for that matter, CCPA compliance, approximately 100% of the results are going to be from firms that are selling ways to obey the letter but not the spirit of the privacy law. In other words, how can you do your cookie notice, or how can you do your do not sell my information notice in the case of the GDPR and the CCPA respectively, in such a way that we can continue to do our business as usual? And you talk about the norms. The norm has been for at least the last 10 years basically taking zero defense on the individual side and harvesting as much possible personal information for marketing purposes from that. And I'm wondering, you know, whether or not the kind of measures you've been talking about for fun and profit on with the GDPR, with, I'm sorry, the CCPA, gives us as users, as individuals, a chance to just put a big board in the spokes of that thing. You know, can we actually like break the machine with, you know, the machine is busy basically just trying to spy on us as a matter of course. You know, that's, we've had this for a long time. Can we break it? Can we break it? Because we have with the CCPA rather, an opportunity and a way to hack it.
Yeah. And that's the thing that can be encouraging about changes in regulation, because at first it seems like every company in the world is against fixing users' privacy, because you've got an entire Lumascape, which is this famous slide of like 7,000 different companies that are all doing miscellaneous things with people's personal information. You've got this whole Lumascape of companies that all have an interest in the status quo. And so it looks like it's end users with limited time and limited information against this giant distributed machine of all these big companies trying to do all this stuff with their information. But of course, that's not what happened with the environmental movement. With the environmental movement, as soon as user norms around pollution in the environment started being captured in law, we started seeing companies making a good business out of implementing those environmental norms. And so now you don't just have an industry of monolithic pollution maximizers. You've got multiple industries with different sets of alignment on user pollution norms.
It's interesting because in many ways, the environmental movement took off with Earth Day, which was actually born here in Santa Barbara. And what really got it going was seagulls covered with oil. And I'm almost imagining like users covered with ants or tracking beacons or something like that. You know, there's I was reading something that said, you know, that if cookies had been called something else like worms or the tracking beacons they actually are, things might be different. I have a, this is a slight subject shift, but it's one that I know you've educated me on, and I think it's important for our listeners and viewers, which is the, and you touched on it earlier, the different kinds of advertising. One of the things that when we talk about advertising, it used to be we talked about, you know, what we saw on TV, heard on the radio, read in newspapers, or up until about 10 years ago, would see on a web page. And now there's search advertising, and there's the kind that's based on tracking. And these are different breeds. And one of the things that I learned from you is that what we're doing here, the ads that I'm going to read on this show, I read one already, and I'm going to read another one. These are sponsors. They're not here because they're tracking people. They're here because they like our show and they like our audience, and they think that that it's useful for everybody if they're sponsor the show. So I'm wondering if you could pull those apart a little bit, because they're all called advertising, even though some of it is more like direct marketing.
Right. And when you advertise on a podcast with an ad unit that is read by the host, then that's probably the best example of advanced applied behavioral economics, because what you're doing as a seller of a product is sending an economic signal that's hard to fake. Now, the best example of advertising that I can think of to get this point across is the old Computer Shopper magazine. Doc, do you remember getting Computer Shopper?
I do. It was this thick. It was gigantic. There was so much stuff for sale at all times.
It was that thick, and it was all ads, and people basically bought it for the ads. So why would you buy a magazine that's full of ads? Today on the internet, people too easily fall into the trap of thinking of ad models and subscription models as opposites, but they're really a complement and they're a cooperative game. Because back in the day, if you're building a PC and you're looking at Computer Shopper to buy parts, you've got questions you need to resolve. Like, is PCI going to take off? Should I buy a PCI motherboard or should I get a VLP motherboard? Well, the only way that you know about the future value of that investment is to understand the future market for compatible products. So if you read through Computer Shopper and you see, oh, well, there's some PCI motherboards in here, but hey, look at all these great PCI video cards. You got a PCI SCSI card. You got a PCI everything. You can see that the market is deliberately spending money on an ad, and those vendors are, by placing those ads, they're signaling their commitment to that product and to the network effects that go along with that product. In an advertising medium where the ad can be targeted directly to the user, then if I pick out one system that has questionable network effects, I'm not accurately able to judge that because I'm getting targeted with ads that are related to the niche that I've been put into. If I go read Fine Woodworking magazine, I know that I'm seeing the same ads for the same woodworking tools that people actually know how to do woodworking are seeing. I'm not getting whatever crappy tools they think they can get the noobs to buy, and I don't have that kind of assurance in web advertising.
That's great. So I will hopefully demonstrate what you were just talking about with a high signal ad message from our second sponsor, which is LastPass. So this episode of Floss Weekly is also brought to you by LastPass. It's important to have a plan for the unexpected. LastPass can be deployed quickly and in the midst of any event to ensure your business keeps running smoothly and every employee login is secure. A single sign-on manages employee access to centralized views, so IT always has insight into who has access to what and from where. Enterprise password management ensures oversight of shadow IT and enforceable policies across all password-protected accounts. Multi-factor authentication requires additional factors to prove a user's identity, while the use of biometric and contextual factors makes the process smooth for employees. Businesses should be thinking about additional layers of defense beyond the password. LastPass, for that reason, does not send or store the master password. If LastPass can't access your data, hackers can't either. Encryption happens exclusively at the device level before syncing to LastPass for safe storage, so only users can decrypt their data. And they use 256-bit AES encryption that is the same encryption type utilized by banks and the military. LastPass protects while providing a seamless workflow for your employees. Account access and passwords can be shared securely between employees, whether they're in the office or they're remote. Employees will get secure access to their network applications with SSO and password management. And there's an offline mode for both password management and multi-factor authentication, so employees can always access what they need. We use LastPass here at Twit, and our experience is entirely a positive one. It's LastPass is there's enormous dependence on that. LastPass can help make remote work simple and secure. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help your business stay productive and secure no matter what. That's LastPass.com/twit. So an additional point to the ones you're just making, Don, and you can amplify on these. But I've heard this, and I'm pretty sure it's true. Like as much as $2 trillion has been spent on tracking-based advertising. It kind of wants to direct market to you personally based on what's been harvested about you. While not a single brand known to the world has been made by that. Meanwhile, almost every brand that you can name is one that you've learned through advertising. And that may be too simple, but I don't think it is. I think it's a really significant fact.
Yeah, I think some of the counterexamples to that may be the DTC brands, like Dollar Shave Club and Warby Parker, that that do a very social media and targeting focused ad campaign to do their launch. But I think a lot of the brands that people think of as the kind of brands you don't have to think about are brands that were built by taking advantage of the signaling properties of less targetable media.
It's interesting. I only wear glasses when I'm looking at the computer, so maybe I'm not known as a glasses wearer. I've only seen Warby Parker ads on standard media, so I don't think Warby Parker's been tracking me, nor has I've never seen a Dollar Shave Club ad. I don't even know what that looks like. And I do shave some parts of my face anyway, on occasion. But that's part of the weird experience of this. We don't all have the same experience because it's all being so custom to us by this thing that I think you characterize or help me characterize is this, the Lumascape is this four-dimensional shell game of intermediaries between the advertiser and the individual and what goes on there. And, you know, and in some ways, in a crude way, I think the GDPR and the CCPA were attempts to simplify that in some way. I don't know. I'm probably not characterizing that quite right.
Well, CCPA still has two missing parts besides the three access rights that I mentioned. There's still some pieces that need to come together in order to make it transformative. So it's kind of like CCPA is the legal payload, but you need the tooling and the delivery system around it to make an effective impact on the market. And those two missing pieces are authorized agent services and some kind of credible opt-out token that can be shared.
There was a browser solution that I think Microsoft, and it may have been Firefox as well, or Chrome. It's been a while since I looked into this, but the Do Not Track token, wasn't that popular back, seems like not very long ago?
Yes, Do Not Track is still a thing that you can turn on in some browsers. And the problem with the Do Not Track header is it's an HTTP header that expresses a preference on the part of the user, but it's not actually connected to any legal infrastructure that backs it up. Now, in CCPA, there is legal language that says if the user has a CCPA compliant do not sell setting, and if that setting is deliberately turned on by the user, then when a site sees that, they have to honor it. And so the lawyers who look at CCPA compliance have looked at the question of the existing do not track header and said, hey, is this a CCPA do not sell? And some of them say, yes, it is. Some of them say, no, it isn't. And so there's some effort in the web standardization scene to try to come up with a browser setting that is unambiguously a CCPA compliant do not sell, that no company would have any excuse to ignore. And that discussion is actually happening over at the World Wide Web Consortium, in one of the working groups that they have looking at this material.
I would imagine that if it's not happening already, very soon it will happen, that there is also a legal fight. Someone will bring a lawsuit that says that this do not track token should be considered CCPA compliant, and then it'll go through the court system too.
Yeah, CCPA doesn't give you a private right of action to enforce that kind of stuff. There's a private right of action in CCPA if your data is breached. So it might be possible to keep track of whoever ignores your do not track and then keep watching your email address on Have I Been Pwned? And when one of the companies that ignored your do not track gets your data pwned, then you've got a private right of action. But it's kind of like a set of legal pieces that need to be strung together by a legal team with the skill and the time to make it stick.
As many people are as interested in this topic, and as many companies get their databases either breached or they just don't set them up right and they leave them open to the internet, I don't imagine that will take very long.
No, it's an example of the kind of situation we saw in the U.S. with an environmental law called the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. And what RCRA told companies is, guess what? You have to fill out a form with the EPA and let the EPA know a list of all the hazardous materials you have on the premises. And people expected that there would be a large record-keeping burden on companies because of RCRA. And what ended up happening is a lot of companies took a look at the big form and decided, well, we don't really need all that toxic stuff gathering dust in the chemical cabinet at the back of the workshop. So let's just pay somebody to take all that stuff out of there and have our compliance effort be a lot simpler.
So I see sort of two questions here. One is, for our purposes as the users, as the will there be a simple way to keep track of this stuff? I mean, right now I assume that if I've told Condé Nast, I noticed the Condé Nast publications, which are the New Yorker, Vogue, Wired, others, have in bold face on if you go there the first time, it'll say, click here to do not sell my data. So, but I assume that I get as a user, I get a cookie and I travel around with that cookie on that browser. But then I use four or five browsers. So how do I remember that? It seems like the burden of recall is always on the server side rather than the client side. And there's no simple way on the client side to keep track of this stuff. So I'm wondering if do you see something like that emerging where people have a better sense of the commitments they've acquired from the sites and services they deal with to obey their requests?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. Right now where we are with CCPA, it's as if I said, hey, doc, you can send me some email. Here's my IP address. And telnet to port 25 and type in an SMTP transaction manually, and I'll get the email. And, of course, I've got a perfectly good email server there, but only a few really dedicated nerds are going to go to the trouble of learning SMTP and typing the protocol correctly on the command line just to get email through to me. So that's essentially where we are now with CCPA. The opportunity is for people to write the equivalent of a mail client for CCPA. So instead of having to do the email protocol yourself, you would have an interface that lets you keep track of the data practices you like and don't like, and how you have expressed your preferences to the companies that need to hear about it.
That's an interesting solution. I was just, in fact, I was mentioning in the back chat here, this idea puts companies potentially in a weird catch 22 where, you know, if we say, well, the company needs to, you know, maintain state on their side, whether or not this user wants to be tracked, they're in this weird place where they then have to track the user to determine whether or not the users opted in or opted out of tracking.
Right. So at some scale, it's more cost effective to avoid certain practices entirely so that you don't need to log who's in and who's out of which practices.
Right. This is, if we think about this from another way, we're really talking about the same problem as the search bubble, aren't we? Where, you know, once Google determines what side of the fence you are on a certain topic, you then search for questions and you get answers that come from the same perspective as you do. It's kind of the same ball of yarn as ad tracking, isn't it?
Yeah. And we see this with the problem that that advertisers tend to want to get their ads in front of younger and wealthier people. And so if you can buy ad impressions that are just people ages 18 to 54 and in a certain income bracket, then as an advertiser, you buy just those impressions, you let the other ones go. And of course, all the ad impressions that get served to older or poorer people are still there, but who's going to buy them? Not the mainstream brands that want to target demographically or behaviorally. All those lower value impressions end up being available for scams.
Now, isn't this has essentially been done for years, though. You know, you think back before the internet even existed, people knew the demographics of who was watching a given television show or, you know, listening to a given radio station. And advertisers would select ads based on that demographic information they had available. I mean, you mentioned scams. Well, I remember very well, you know, if you're up at 2 or 3 in the morning and you turn cable TV on, what's going to be playing at those particular times? Well, it's going to be some infomercial that is a glorified scam of some sort. So in some ways, this isn't a new problem. It's just now that we have the technology and the internet, we've kind of turbocharged the problem, haven't we?
Yeah. And instead of selecting into lower quality ads by watching those late night infomercials, some algorithm has decided to select you into those ads. So for a while, I was getting ads for warehouse jobs and delivery jobs, like make money delivering holiday packages for Amazon, UPS, whatever services. And I thought, okay, this is not something I have time for right now, but it's interesting that I'm getting targeted with those ads. And then all of a sudden, I start getting targeted with ads for treating what look like really, really difficult bowel conditions. Like you've got something wrong with the lower part of your digestive system that requires you to really pay a lot of attention to that. And instantly all the warehouse and delivery job ads stopped. So somewhere out there, there's an algorithm that's decided we don't want somebody who's going to need as many men's room breaks as this guy clearly is going to need working in our giant warehouse or driving a truck for us. And it's funny when I tell it, but what about the person who really wants or needs that warehouse job? Why are they being discriminated out of an offer that they might have really wanted?
So in thinking about this, one of the big differences between, you know, the example I gave of, you know, ye old TV or radio show and the internet today is in the old days, on that traditional media source, you have an easy ability to opt out of a given ad. If you don't like the ads that are being played during a certain TV show or on a certain channel, you can just not watch or change the channel. Whereas on the internet today, on a lot of ad sources, there's not an easy button to say, this ad does not apply to me. I really would prefer not to see ads like this. Show me something else. Is that kind of the essential problem that we're seeing?
Yeah, and it's something where you can use your CCPA rights against that advertiser. So if there's a particular advertiser who is targeting you, then you can CCPA them and they no longer have the ability to, quote, sell, which includes a bunch of other information transfers. They no longer have the ability to sell your information in such a way that they can put you in that bubble.
And then in thinking about this, it's actually in a company's best interest to, and I'm sure there's some debate about whether the CCPA is the perfect way to go about this, but it's in a company's best interest to not send you ads that don't apply, annoy you, and you're never going to act on. The kind of ads that people would find interesting, would find useful, that kind of meets up with, it synergizes, to use the buzzword, with what would actually be best for the company that's paying for the advertisements. Like in an ideal world, the algorithms would just work and there would be this perfect marriage of you know, what a company provides and what a user needs, and they would meet together properly. And I think it's interesting to see whether the CCPA is actually going to kind of help make that happen, or, you know, in a worst case scenario, it's just going to get in the way.
Yeah. And advertising is a form of communication that has two characteristics to it. One of them is its interruption, and the other is economic signal. And so if you have interruption without economic signal, then it's spam. If you have economic signal without interruption, it's content marketing. If you have neither interruption nor economic signal, it's organic social. So why does advertising persist in the kind of media where people choose not to block it? And the reason that advertising can persist in a medium is because the signal pays for the interruption. You don't want to be interrupted, but you gain enough knowledge about that seller's intentions in the market that you're willing to accept that interruption. So Rory Sutherland at Ogilvy compared it to seeing a horse owner bet on their own horse. Well, they've got information about that horse that you don't. And when a vendor chooses to do a bigger ad placement for a particular product, then they're investing money in sending you a signal about their belief in that product.
So what can or should we do as citizens, not just as users, but as citizens, to affect future laws or to affect the evolution of whatever the CCPA becomes? I know in Europe with the GDPR, they bake these things for years and before, there's already a lot in the pipeline for the GDPR and its successor laws in Europe. And I'm wondering if in California or in other states, for that matter, or at the federal level here, if the Democrats win, across the board, we're going to have a whole lot of new policy because that's what they like to do. What should we be doing on that front? Should it be activist stuff? Should it be, whatever? I mean, I'm just wondering if you thought much about that.
Well, from a policy point of view, I think that joining an organization that's been active in California, Consumer Reports, which I'm working with right now on a CCPA related project, has done a tremendous amount of excellent advocacy around privacy law and policy. And so if you see that California has the CCPA and you'd like your state to have something similar or copy parts of the CCPA, then joining an advocacy organization that tracks those laws is a good way to find out how to get involved.
That's good. So we're getting toward the end of the hour here, and we have three questions we tend to like to ask guests. The first one is very open-ended and go for a bit, which is there anything we haven't asked you that you would like us to have asked?
Oh, I think that the big question is, how do you get marketers to move money away from creepy things and toward higher signal win-win forms of advertising?
That's good. And I don't have the answer to that. I've been failing at that for a long time. The second one is, do you have anything to say about blockchain?
I like blockchain for certain kinds of applications. I think it would be a lot less confusing if instead of saying, quote, on the blockchain, you'd say, quote, in a Git repository with one branch and no files. Because if you can do something in that type of data structure, then you can do it on the blockchain. I don't think that blockchains as a specific kind of data structure are as relevant to the questions of personally identifiable information as a lot of people made it out to be. But I think that some of the computer science ideas from the blockchain scene will help us inform future data structures, something that might be kind of the spawn of a blockchain and a web of trust for storing hard to repudiate pieces of data on which there's a consensus.
Yeah, it has been interesting how I'm seeing a lot of people avoiding using the term blockchain now. It's a distributed ledger. It's a distributed database. It's some other thing. I think I liked your. I can't remember it exactly, but you know the GitHub repository answer is actually a very good and useful one for, especially for our audience here. The third question is, what's your and I actually know. I think in your case, what's your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Favorite text editor has been Vim for quite a while.
Yeah.
So I have some Vim macros for things that I often say in email. I have some Vim shortcuts for working with Markdown, and of course all the support for the programming that I do.
Fantastic. Well, it has been really great having you here, and I hope the audience will pick up on a lot of what you had to share with us. It's been really terrific. We're going have to have you back again.
Do you have show notes? Because I've got a link for a CCPA experiment that people can try out and participate in.
Yeah, we do. We do have show notes. So when this goes up, we can include those.
Great. I'll send you the link.
Right. Fantastic. Well, thanks for being with us. So Jonathan, how do you think that went? I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's kind of outside of the normal talk about an open source piece of software that, you know, Floss Weekly has historically been. But I think that's neat. I think it's good to kind of expand the boundaries of what we get to talk about. And I really enjoyed getting to talk with Don there. He seems like a neat guy. And the CCPA, it's interesting. I always find it interesting when you have these laws and they have unexpected consequences, which I think we all know that anytime we make a law about anything, there's going to be something that we didn't anticipate. Just like when you write code, you have unexpected consequences. And I thought it was really fun to think about the positive unexpected consequences of the CCPA and the negative consequences as well. You know, I mean, like we talked about, there might be a problem for small businesses that the thing I was thinking about is you have a small business who uses something like Patreon, tiny, tiny little business uses Patreon. Well, suddenly that might expose them to some sort of additional burden or restrictions because of this new law. And so it's really fascinating to think about and to talk through those issues. But I think this is the future. You know, so many people are so concerned about this and care about it so much. I think it's something that, you know, kind of collectively we're going to have to come to some conclusions about and codify into law.
Well, a couple of things there. One is that, you know, just in terms of unintended consequences and stuff like that, I'm sort of an old fashioned Silicon Valley libertarian in the sense that I think most new laws protect yesterday from last Thursday and then last for another 50 years and become obsolete. In the case of the GDPR, I think it protected 2015 from 2012, you know, when it went into effect in 2018, and has hardly been enforced in a way that, you know, I think it's been a mess. And I think that the cookie notice thing is absurd. And that's another one where, you know, the laws are bizarre. And I think, I mean, what Don's been exceptionally good at, I think, is looking at these things and thinking, how can I screw with this in a really positive and interesting way? I think he's the leading character in that kind of approach to this stuff. So, it's really front of mind for me, actually. It's been perverse.
So. Yeah. You always see weird things when you have politicians writing laws about technical issues. You get things like, okay, now every website is going to tell you that they serve cookies. Well, of course every website serves cookies. That's how the web works.
I know. I think I've said this before. I've over my doorbell it says it may have fallen off now, but it says, this house uses molecules. Please accept its use of molecules. And you press the doorbell. You know, it's completely silly. Any plugs you want to come in here with and tell people where to find you for whatever purposes they might have?
Yes. So one of the other things that I get to do on a weekly basis is over at Hackaday.com. I think it was like Friday mornings, we run a security column that I get to write. So would recommend everybody, if you care about computer security and you want to stay up with some of the topics that I found interesting, at least, go check that out. And then I have theoretically an article coming up soon looking at Chromebooks and all the ways that hackers can abuse and take advantage of those, and that should be interesting too.
Wow, I'm thinking of getting a Chromebook, so I should probably consult you on exactly what to do with that. I want to let everybody know that next week's show is going to be with Salona Bonewald. Salona's an old friend. I met her at South By back in the early days of South By, and she's been with the Hyperledger Foundation at the Linux Hyperledger Project, the Linux Foundation, and she just went over to the IEEE, and I'm really curious to know what she's going to be doing there. So thanks so much, everybody, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, I'm Jason Howell, host of Hands on Android, a techie look at how to customize your Android device, as well as take a look underneath the hood and see what's really going on down there. You can subscribe by going to twit.tv/HOA, or you can find Hands on Android in your podcatcher of choice.